give my voice a little bit of a rest. But it'd be great to turn back to Psalm 137. I'll get some water as well. Because in our series on questions, tonight the question that someone sent in was this, sort of generic questions. How about something about facing our own doubts pertaining to faith, etc., and ways we might help others who share their doubts with us? So how do you wrestle with doubts? How do you help other people who are wrestling with doubts? And I thought about that, and I tried to think of a particularly appropriate passage that we could do that. And I thought, why don't we attack it from a different angle tonight and not just look at a passage that helps us deal with doubts, but actually look at a passage that raises doubts as well. So you've sort of got it from both angles. As James read that verse 9, I'm sure we're all thinking, what do you do with psalms like this? So I thought I'd deliberately tackle a passage like this, as I say, because I think it speaks to dealing with doubts, but also because it addresses, it raises those doubts in the first place. But to get us into this psalm, in a moment, Maura's going to show you a video clip. Now, I want to explain, this is not mere indulgence. We're not watching this just totally to relive my childhood, because you'll recognise this song. But while you listen to it, I want you to think about two things. It's not just a little bit reminiscing, two things. How, as Boney M sing this song, I'm sure you remember, how do they use the word Babylon? So if you grew up in a Caribbean culture, particularly a Rastafarian, what does a Rastafarian mean when they say the word Babylon? Think about that. And the second thing I want you to do as you listen to this is think about how it makes you feel. Psalms are supposed to make us feel something. So, yeah, just listen to this. What does Babylon mean? How does it make you feel? Thanks.
I think we've lost sound, which is sort of somewhat the point of it.
You can sing it, John.
Nice one. Oops. We're going to start again, I think. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
There you go. And we cut off then, because then actually, if you know the song, it goes on to Psalm 19. It leaves Psalm 137 behind. But just hold those thoughts in a minute. I'm going to ask you for your comments in a moment. But first of all, a little bit of history. So what's going on in the psalm? The psalm is written just after Jerusalem has fallen. The people are in exile. And in order to understand the psalm, you've got to do a lot of work to understand what they mean by Zion, or what we would call Jerusalem, and what they mean by Babylon. So we need to see that Zion does not just mean Jerusalem, the city. In the Bible, it's coming on to mean a lot more than that. It's not just in the Middle East. It's fulfilled in Jesus. It's foreshadowed in the church. And according to Hebrews and Revelation, it's actually waiting to come down from heaven. But not just Zion in the Bible is taking on a bigger sort of symbolic function. The word Babylon is too. So for example, in the Old Testament books of Ezra and Nehemiah, the Persian kings, so this Babylon is fallen and you've got the Persian Empire, but it's interesting, in those books, the Persian kings are also called the kings of Babylon. In other words, Babylon, all the way from the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11, all the way through, is increasingly taking on a symbolic function in the way that Zion does. So let's think about Babylon. Anybody know? So when a Rastafarian says Babylon, they're not talking about a place in Iraq. What does a Rastafarian mean by Babylon? Anybody know? No, not at all. The opposite. Don't you know anything about Rastafarian culture? You've got to. It's connected to slavery. I mean. Well, yeah, it could be America. No, but it's more generic than that. Babylon would mean a government that's opposed to you. So you could even call the police Babylon, possibly. You might hear the Rastafarians called police. Sort of it's hostile government forces are oppressing you. That's what Babylon means. But can you see the way that, I mean, obviously they've taken that from, Rastafarians have taken that from Old Testament language, that in the Bible, Babylon, it doesn't just mean a place. It, over time, comes to stand for human society opposed to God. And Zion is basically the opposite. Zion comes to symbolize God's people living in God's place under God's rule. So giving us a bit of sort of background history to this, you could say that the whole story of the Bible is a tension between Babylon and Zion. In fact, what we're going to see in this psalm is that the main point of the psalm is that to be loyal to Zion, you must be sure that Babylon falls. Now, that's a bit of history. And now we come back to our original question. So how do you deal with doubts? How do you help people struggle with doubts? Well, I think the psalmist tells us to do three things. Number one, mind the gap. Number two, keep the faith. And number three, long for the end. So mind the gap, keep the faith, long for the end. And I'm going to have a cough sweet at that point. So first of all, look at verses 1 to 4. Mind the gap. Something that anybody uses the tube should be very familiar with that phrase, mind the gap. And it's the first thing the psalmist tells us to do. Do you notice that verses 1 to 4 are separate because they're corporate? It's collective language, we. The deep grief of the church in exile. Look at verses 1 to 4. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? Can you see the problem that they're facing? The problem is that they are Zion, Jerusalem, is in ruins. And there they are by the rivers, the waters of Babylon. We don't know, that could have been the river Euphrates, the Tigris, Probably it was the canals that Babylon was so famous for, the irrigated canals which provided the hanging gardens of Babylon. We saw the picture in the Boney M song. That's the image. You think of the city of London today, you go right into the centre of town and these magnificent buildings that just speak of the, you know, historical power of when Britain was an empire. Well, the Jews would have been the same. They're sitting right in the seat of Babylon and they're seeing these incredible buildings. How can they sing songs about Zion? How can they do that? And that's the first thing I want us to do tonight is, do you really feel that? As Boney M was singing that song, do you? I really struck, as I listened to that again, I'd almost forgotten it, but as you listen to the words, that particular line really struck me, not just my head, but my heart. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? I know, for example, some of you sitting here tonight probably can remember days when Christian Endeavour in this church, there were literally hundreds of young people coming. And you sang songs, the songs of the Lord, hundreds of young people being discipled. And now we live in a land where church attendance is going down and down and down. Don't you know, how can you sing the same songs that you sang triumphantly then? How can you sing them now? Can you feel that? Have you wept? Because the psalmist tells us to remember, doesn't he? We remembered Zion, and that's a particular word. That's not just a coincidental word he chose. Remembered is intentional. It's remembering. It's got associations with a covenant. We don't know exactly. Presumably they were singing. Some of these songs they're talking about were probably maybe Psalm 46 or Psalm 48. I'm sure you know Psalm 46. Martin Luther famously brought it into his hymn. Here's some verses from it. This is from Psalm 46. There is, listen again to the connection. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her. She will not fall. God will help her at break of day. Now, those words would sound ridiculous, wouldn't they, in Babylon? I mean, how you can feel it with them, can't you? How can we sing that? How can we sing Psalm 46 in Babylon? To sing that song is to invite questions and doubts, isn't it? Only the person who sticks their head in the sand could possibly sing that song in Babylon and not have profound questions and angst and anxiety. And then fast forward, you could imagine possibly Jesus himself singing Psalm 137 as he weeps over Jerusalem. Okay, the people are back in the physical city of Jerusalem, but Zion is still in exile. So you can think the Jews of Jesus' day also say, Lord, how can we sing these songs? Hear him weep. So I think one of the things the Psalms do is teach us, help us to feel what we're supposed to feel. And do you feel that on a Sunday? I hope the songs that we sing most of the time raise your hearts and want you to praise the Lord. But do you ever feel that when you sing a song? Do you feel that mismatch that we're gathered together on a Sunday, we're singing these songs, but actually the song doesn't seem to really fit with real life? Because we're supposed to. We, according to the psalmist, we should always feel that mismatch. But even more so in exile. So, on a Sunday, we sing maybe, I can think of one, children's chorus, where we sing about Jesus healing the leper, but then the Lord won't heal my daughter. Or we sing of a God who saves, but he doesn't save those whom we love dearly. Or we sing about a great God whose kingdom is growing, but we live in a society where less and less people go to church. How do we live with that kind of tension? The psalmist encourages us to wrestle with those doubts and those questions. See, mind the gap I want us to see tonight, that it is a sign of faith to ask questions about that gap. Often on a Sunday morning, I think at the door, people expect, I want them to say, oh, that was a really nice service today, John. But I've got to be honest, I would, you know, not everybody, but I would actually take it as a good thing if some people were angry or asking questions or saying sort of, you know, you've just said that, but that does not square with my experience at all. Let's talk about this. Because that would be a sign of life. That would show that, you know, people were listening and actually engaging and putting what we've just sung and looked at alongside their actual lives. So mind the gap is really important. It is a sign of faith seeking understanding. And that's the first thing I want us to see. If you're struggling with doubts, if you've got friends who are struggling with doubts, I want us to see, according to Psalm 137, that that is a healthy thing. In fact, the opposite. The psalmist is saying, if we live in a world which is not yet Zion, and it clearly isn't, then you should be asking questions. There should be some doubt sometimes. If there isn't, you're not really listening to what God's word says. Sadly, some churches give the impression that doubts need to be suppressed. And the faith means never raising those kind of deep questions. But here we see Psalm 137 teaches exactly the opposite. The present experience of a Christian is in part that we live in Babylon, but we long for Zion. And if on a Sunday, if during the week, if our faith doesn't express that tension in any way, it's not really biblical faith. We're kind of avoiding the hard stuff. So, you have a chance to ask questions later, but that's the first thing. Mind the gap. Actually, doubts and questioning that tension is a good thing to do. But secondly, keep the faith in verses 5 to 6. Keep the faith. Notice that the voice changes. So verses 1 to 4 was we, and now verses 5 to 6 are in the first person, I. It's the presumably the author of the psalm speaking. He says, if I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you. If I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Can you see how the psalm changes tack dramatically there? If it was written by a kind of ancient Israelite, Matt Redman, then you can see that verse 6 is the worst curse, self-curse, a musician can ask for, isn't it? That's worth noticing that a lot of people misunderstand this psalm and the other psalms. There are no curses in this psalm, as we're going to see, except for verse 6, which is a self-curse. The only thing you could call a curse in this psalm is that he is saying, if I forget you, then I want, you know, as a musician, my right hand not to work and my tongue to stick to the roof of my mouth so I can't sing. And, you know, as a singer, as a musician, that's sort of the worst thing possible. But also notice here, and again, hope that as we move from the we to the I, and as it were, he is trying to sort of pull them along and encourage them as they express their doubts. He's trying to encourage them to then keep the faith, that there is an interesting interplay between the older and younger generation here, which again I think we need to acknowledge. I don't want to read too much into it, but in this psalm and other psalms that you read, you get the feeling almost as if in exile the older generation are tired and weary and sad by what's happened. But the younger generation are beginning to think, well, actually, maybe it's not true at all. Do you see that kind of sort of move? That the older generation are, well, you know, we thought it was all about Zion and the Lord made these promises. And now the younger generation are starting to see which way the wind is blowing. And they're starting to think, well, maybe we shouldn't be following the Lord at all. And we should be going with these Babylonian gods. And therefore, what he's trying to do is say, in effect, that for the older generation to help the younger generation in growing in their faith, again, it's a healthy thing to express those questions. Because it's when we pretend we don't have them, when the first generation pretends, oh no, it's all fine and we'll just carry on as we are, that's when the younger generation starts to say, well, you know, this they're just doing this because of tradition. There's nothing really in it. It doesn't really have any answers to the questions of today. And so expressing our doubts and fears enables each subsequent generation to face up to the challenge of the Gospels and to see that it's not easy, but it is real and it's relevant and it connects with my life now. That faith is like a muscle. It grows when you stretch it and exercise it. When you just sort of keep it stationary, it dies away. I've been reading a book by the Puritan Richard Sibbes. He's writing in the 17th century, a great book called The Bruised Reed. Really helpful book from a pastoral perspective. And it's written for bruised reeds, people who have been bruised by sin or suffering or doubt. And lots of great quotes in it. One of this is in the book is this. He writes, "Nothing is so certain as that which is certain after doubts. Nothing is so certain as that which is certain after doubts." And I know it seems counterintuitive, but Richard Sibbes is saying is that faith actually grows stronger when you wrestle with hard questions and doubts, etc. That's how faith grows. When you kind of keep it in a box, you know, in the bedroom, away from questions, that's when it dies. So this individual voices his personal loyalty to the Lord, and he challenges the people and says, hey, yeah, raise your questions, mind the gap, but also keep the faith in so doing. In fact, notice that word forget, which connects with the remember of verse 1. Again, an intentional remembering or forgetting of the covenant. And what does he mean to keep the faith? Well, it's there in verse 6 at the end. Setting Jerusalem as my highest joy. And therefore, that helps us understand what we do when we meet together on a Sunday, for example, that we sing songs, praising the Lord, like the ones we've just sung tonight, not as a way of dodging questions, not a way of sort of pretending that there aren't any issues, but it's more of a heart thing, isn't it? It's a way of setting your heart on Zion, on Jerusalem, on God's place with his people as the highest place. That's what I mean by keep the faith. I don't mean keep the faith in the sense of sort of ignore questions. I mean the psalmist is encouraging us to set our hearts on Jerusalem. And as I say, Zion, it means that sense of God dwelling with his people in paradise. Set our hearts on that and everything will begin to fall into place. So that is not the same as saying the way you respond to doubts is just believe. I'm not saying that at all. It's an act of the will and it involves the mind, of course. But ultimately, it's a heart thing. To set Jerusalem as my highest joy does not mean that I've got all the answers about Zion or Babylon. But it means that I'm trusting in the Lord. Ultimately, I'm saying, in effect, I don't understand all these things. But I trust you, Lord, that you are good and I'm just going to cling on to you. That everything will make sense when we get to Zion. Then the world will be right. So, number one, mind the gap. Number two, keep the faith. And then number three, smash the babies. No, that's not right. My third point is really long for the end, although you would think it would be smash the babies from the way the psalm goes. Verses 7 to 9. The confidence that the enemies of the church in exile will be removed. Verse 7. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction. Happy is the one who repays you according to what you've done to us. Happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. Lots of problems there, so let's just say them one at a time. First of all, what's so bad about the Edomites in verse 7? Well, the quickest way to answer that question is read the book of Obadiah. Don't have time to do it now, but the Edomites were cousins of Israel, so they were, as it were, you know, a very closely related tribe. And that made their betrayal all the more painful. Because when Jerusalem fell, to the Babylonians, the Edomites, their cousins as it were, they joined in. Listen to how Obadiah describes it. Obadiah here is describing the actions of the Edomites when the Babylonians ransacked Jerusalem. This is from Obadiah, verse 11 and 12. On the day you stood aloof, while strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. You should not gloat over your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction. So with that in mind, the terrible things that the Edomites did to the people of Jerusalem, listen carefully to what the psalmist says in verse 7. Notice he does not call for revenge. Instead, he asks the Lord to remember what the Edomites had done. He prays, but he does not curse. This was a terrible betrayal. This was like Judas, a brother, betraying Jesus. It was a terrible betrayal. And the psalmist is not calling for revenge, but he is saying, Lord, remember what they did. Similarly, verses 8 and 9 are not curses either. As I say, the only curse in the psalm is the self-curse of verse 6. Instead, what they do is express a confidence that God will judge the wicked. The psalmist is saying, in effect, heaven is only possible if the wicked are removed. Zion can only rise if Babylon falls. In fact, the word translated happy there in verses 8 and 9 is normally rendered blessed. Not happy as an emotion, but blessed in the sense of doing God's will. So he's not praying for revenge. Instead, he is praying that God's will be done as the wicked are removed. Now, that might seem like a really pedantic distinction, but it isn't. We tend to think that, well, if God's will is that the wicked are removed, that means he actively wants the way it happens. But throughout the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, regularly it's put both ways. So, for example, in Isaiah chapter 10, Assyria is described as being God's will, that Assyria is sent by God to judge the Israelites. But then in the same chapter, Assyria is also described as being judged for the evil way that she did it. So the Old Testament is quite happy to say that, yes, this is part of God's will, but that doesn't mean that the way that happens is necessarily a morally good thing. And then again, it might be tempting to write off this psalm as being, well, it's the Old Testament and, you know, Christians don't follow that anymore. But the problem is that in Revelation 18 in the New Testament, exactly the same things are said about Babylon, looking to the future. So this is quoting from Revelation 18. The Apostle John is talking about Babylon. And he says, woe, woe to you, great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In one hour she has been brought to ruin. Rejoice over her, you heavens. Rejoice, you people of God. Rejoice, apostles and prophets. For God has judged her with the judgment she imposed on you. So unfortunately, the message of the New Testament is about Babylon is exactly the same as the New Testament. It is God's will for Babylon to be removed so that Zion can come. And similarly with the horrific words of verse 9, again, the psalmist is not praying that he wants this to happen. It's not like a curse, but he is saying that it's God's will for the wicked to be wiped out. It's a horrific image, isn't it? But it's an image that would be very common at their time. In fact, it's an image that was particularly associated with the Assyrians and the Babylonians. It was their military strategy. A kind of form of genocide that the Assyrians were famous for it and the Babylonians, killing young men, babies, even ripping open pregnant women as a way of stopping this nation or tribe from fighting back. So as we wrestle with verse 9, you're kind of wondering, aren't you? Your heart is thinking, how can this be true? Is this all about revenge? Is there something else going on? Maybe the main point the psalmist is making is that the self-regenerating power of Babylon is no more. Is Psalm 137 saying that Babylon will keep on spreading her wickedness across the globe until Babylon is stopped from reproducing, in effect. That the only way to be saved, to experience Zion, to know this paradise, is to cease being a Babylonian, an Edomite, and so on. And that the psalmist is not advocating genocide, but rather the opposite, for all nations to become God's people. This is a heart cry for Babylon to be no more, but for it to be replaced instead by Zion. The crime writer P.D. James, I don't know if you know, quite a popular crime writer, P.D. James, in her novel Original Sin, she has a character speaking to a Jewish colleague, and in the book, the character says to a Jewish colleague, "If I had a God, I'd like him to be intelligent, cheerful, and amusing." To which the Jew replies in the book, "I doubt whether you'd find him much of a comfort when they herded you into the gas chambers. Then you might prefer a God of vengeance." Ouch. See, here, these are stark images, confronting images, but ones the psalmist wants us to wrestle with. There are no easy answers. And it reminds me that when I was about six, my uncle, who's a farmer at the time, he took me to an abattoir to see sheep and cattle being slaughtered. And it's really interesting because whenever I tell that story to people, generally the reaction I get, a lot of people feel very sorry for me and think how cruel and wicked my uncle must be to take my sister was only a couple of years older at the time, to take us to see that. But I know him, he's still alive, and he's in his 80s now, and I know exactly what he would say if I said that to him now. He would just shrug his shoulders and say that his job was to take his namby-pamby London-born nephew to discover where the lamb chops he loves so much come from. And I'm telling you that story because I think it's a lot like that with heaven too. We all long for heaven, but we don't like to think about what is going to be necessary for heaven to come to earth. And we thought about it a little bit when James spoke back in January about the difficult issue of hell. What is God supposed to do with those who refuse to accept him as Lord ever? Because if just one person like that got into heaven, it would stop being Zion. It wouldn't be heaven, would it? What is God supposed to do? And that's why I suppose at that point that many people today find the idea of annihilation attractive. That is that when people die, God only resurrects Christians, basically. But this psalm, can you see, it pushes back on that. It takes us even deeper and into more scary, difficult territory that I don't fully understand. Raises issues about human value as beings. This psalm treats all people with dignity and respect, unfortunately, I say. Because apart from the fact that I can't square annihilationism with scripture, the other thing that I really wrestle with, it has such a low value of human life. Because if you think about it, annihilationism is basically saying that human beings are, they're kind of like bits of scrap paper. That if you get one wrong, you can just kind of screw it up and throw it away. But actually, the Bible describes human beings as having such value, because we're created in God's image, that even our decision to reject God is taken seriously by him. Do you see? I'm not saying that deals with all the questions, but these terrible voices point to the sad necessity that Babylon must be removed completely before Zion can be properly built. That before the heavenly Jerusalem can come down, the earthly Babylon must be cleared away totally to make way. And that is why the psalmist ultimately longs for the end. See, if you set Jerusalem as your highest joy, if that's what it means to keep the faith, then your heart will always be restless until you get there. I think that's most of all, if you want something to take away from this psalm about dealing with doubts, I would say that it's the normal experience of a Christian, or should be, to be restless for Zion, to be strangers and aliens on this planet, to be travelling on a journey towards Zion and to never be totally happy until we get there. And yet, let's be honest, so much of contemporary Christianity is very satisfied with the present. And we're quite happy. We want easy answers because we want to be quite comfortable now. But the psalmist picked up, the idea of the psalmist picked up in the New Testament with that kind of, that yearning for home, that actually this world is not totally right yet, but it's going to be one day when Babylon is no more and we're in paradise, as we thought this morning, we're in paradise in Zion with Jesus. And therefore, difficult questions like this can cause us to wrestle with hard truths, can't they? And push us further back into God and further into his plans and leave us on that kind of journey of, yeah, mind the gap, keep the faith, but ultimately longing for the end, longing for Zion, saying, this life is not my home and I'm longing for that day when everything will be put right. And that's what we trust in. Let's pray, and then there'll be some time for questions.